Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we talked in the last segment about the Trump World and Russia investigation, as we're doing every day this month, with events coming so fast and furious. But we're also making sure not to miss the important policy decisions that are being made despite or sometimes under the cover of the attention the investigations are getting. We continue to do that now with the Senate health care bill. Just when you thought repeal and replace Obamacare was dead or on long-term hold, here comes the Senate attempt to revive it by the 4th of July and without a public hearing. Let's find out what can be known about that with Vox health reporter Sarah Cliff. Thanks for doing this, Sarah. Welcome back to WNYC.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Is there a Senate repeal and replace bill emerging?
It seems like there is. It's been a little hard to follow because, as you mentioned, Brian, it's been a pretty secretive process. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has really decided he doesn't want to go through the normal committee route. He wants to get together this kind of ad hoc working group, come up with a bill, get the CBO score, and then vote on it very, very quickly. So the bill is coming together, but it's hard for reporters like me to cover it because, unlike, typical legislating, there aren't hearings we can go to or, you know, committees we can follow up with. It's all really happening behind closed doors.
You wrote an article this week on how President Trump publicly praised the House bill when it was passed, but quietly told senators this week that the House bill is mean. What can you tell us about what he meant by mean?
So I think what he meant by mean was he's really seen a lot of the negative coverage that the the American Health Care Act has gotten. And one of the other things he said was that he wants the Senate to pass something more generous. So I think he is reading a lot of the news coverage that talks about the people who would not have health insurance under this bill. He sees that it's unpopular, and he is essentially, what it seems like my read is that he's asking the Senate to come up with something that is better received. And we don't quite know yet. This was only 2 days ago, and obviously we've had this terrible shooting in between. We don't really know yet how senators are reacting to that guidance. If they do want to take it into account, it probably would change their course a little bit, since everything we've known up until now is that the Senate bill was shaping up to look a lot like the bill that the House passed.
If Trump said come up with something more generous, is it clear that that would mean money is the issue rather than, say, federal guarantees for all Americans that their insurance can't discriminate against pre-existing conditions or include annual or lifetime benefits limitations when you're really sick or those other guarantees that House Republicans want to end in the name of free markets? Do we know what, if the reporting is accurate, that he used the word generous, what Trump meant by generous?
We don't. And I think that's a good point that you raise. It could be interpreted a lot of different ways. The way I read it, having, you know, covered Trump and healthcare for, the better part of a year at this point, is that when he says generous, he wants something people will like more, that people will say, yeah, this is a good deal for me, that I'm not going to be hurt by this bill. And generally, when you think of like what people like in health insurance, they like generous coverage. They like lower deductibles, the ability to see more doctors, the ability to get affordable premiums. So, you know, that's what tends to make health insurance well liked. And so that's how I read, you know, what Trump is talking about there.
Which is why it's so hard to talk about health care and to come up with health care bills, because everybody wants everything and doesn't want to pay for anything. And so then you get into all these gray areas of the trade-offs that nobody wants to make and which trade-offs become more politically acceptable because somebody gets hurt no matter which way you trade off. And it's who's politically powerful and whose ox is being gored. Who's in the leadership on this in the Senate?
So we have Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who's really running this process. He's kind of the guy who is figuring out the deadlines, who's involved in the drafting. He's really at the center of all of this.
Listeners, if you want to call in for Sarah Cliff, health reporter for Vox, on the emerging Senate repeal and replace bill or anything related, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And who are some swing senators, maybe up for re-election next year or otherwise on the hot seat, who will be in a tough spot over this potentially?
Yeah, so a few that I'm watching pretty closely would be someone like Susan Collins from Maine, who is traditionally held a more moderate role in the Republican Party, has been very, very on the fence about the Senate bill. She is someone who I think cares a lot about keeping coverage numbers up. She, you know, was critical of the House bill because it would have led to 23 million Americans losing coverage. So she is someone who I think is a bit of a bellwether to see, you know, if she supports it, then I think there's a very good chance it passes. Another one I would watch closely is Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, who will likely be involved in some negotiating around how this bill treats abortion. One of the things that the House bill does is it defunds Planned Parenthood. Lisa Murkowski is someone who opposes that provision of the bill, and you could see a bit of a fight shaping up between folks who believe it's very important to have those provisions in there and needing to get, you know, the Senate is in a really tight position here. Mitch McConnell can only lose 2 votes and still move this. So really every senator, you know, has a lot of sway in deciding whether this passes. And I think Murkowski and Collins are 2 bellwethers. If they are on board, then this bill is passing.
What's the thing about this bill being secret? I know you mentioned it, but what, you know, why won't they hold a hearing?
That is, I mean, it's a better question for Majority Leader McConnell than I. From what I can gather, there was a really telling quote, I thought, that was given to Caitlin Owens, who's a reporter at Axios, who was asking, you know, some Senate aides, why aren't you doing hearings? And they basically said, the thing they said back was, we're not stupid. They watched the House bill come out. They watched the House bill get pummeled, get a really bad reception, do really poorly in the polls. And they seem to have decided that the best way to move something forward is to keep it really close to the chest, to not let senators get spooked by some bad news stories or negative coverage. And, you know, at some point, the bill becomes public, right? Like, at some point, you have to vote on it, you get a CBO score, and at some point, maybe it even goes into effect. You can only hide a law for so long if it becomes a law. But, you know, it will have real consequences if it passes. And right now, it is, you know, I think one of the things, as you were mentioning in the segment before this, you know, they have really been able to reduce the amount of news coverage of this effort by just not having much in public. If you look at the front pages of newspapers, you won't see a lot of coverage of the Senate healthcare repeal effort. If you kind of look at what people are Googling, for example, you don't see a lot of people searching for information on this like you did around the House bill. I think they are trying to get as little news coverage as possible. And for a reporter like myself, you know, it's a lot easier to write a story about a committee hearing that happens than to write a story saying, you know, something's happening behind closed doors, but we have kind of no event to point to.
Which is exactly why we're doing this segment, because we're not going to let them get away with doing this entirely in secret. We're at least going to talk about it here. Will they actually vote? Can they actually vote before any public hearing or time for public debate, whether or not it's in a Senate chamber or their version being scored? I mean, the House bill got passed before the Congressional Budget Office declared that it would mean 23 million fewer people with insurance.
So the rules in the Senate are a little bit different. The Senate will need a score in order to vote on the bill. And that is to show, because they're using this process called reconciliation, that process requires they have a score to prove that this does save the government some money. So they're under a little bit different rules. We won't see a repeat of what happened in the House. I mean, that being said, it does not necessarily leave a lot of time for public debate. It seems very possible that you could have in quick succession, and by that I mean like within a few days, the bill released, the score come out with it, and a vote in the Senate. Mitch McConnell has said so far that he'd like to have a vote before July 4th, which leaves us, I think, 11 actual working days in between now and then. So that's pretty soon. That doesn't leave a lot of time for discussion. I will say that timeline is starting to look a little bit less plausible as, you know, we go day to day and don't see the bill come out. But that's currently, you know, the timeline that's on the table right now.
Let's take a phone call. Stephanie in the Garment District. You're on WNYC with Sarah Cliff, health reporter for Vox. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I listen to the show lots. I was wondering, what is the difference between the care and out-of-pocket costs to the senator who got shot under the health care that he has for himself versus what he's trying to put into place for the rest of us?
Congressman Steve Scalise. Is he a player in this? Is he a prominent player in this on the House side? Do you know, Sarah?
Yeah, so, I mean, he has the position of majority whip, which means he's the guy who's kind of in charge of making sure when they have a vote, they have enough votes to pass it. And obviously, that was a very, very crucial role in the House caucus, where they were really just, you know, rounding up those very last votes up until the last minute when they had the vote. So he is someone who was quite involved with the House effort, not as much with the Senate, obviously, because he's in the other chamber, but really was someone who was very involved with getting the American Health Care Act through the House.
Well, he is somebody who, because of what happened yesterday, is going to have long-term, very expensive medical bills. What kind of coverage for something like that do members of Congress get?
So members of Congress, I think they get health insurance that would look a lot like plans that many of us at work get with our employment, plans that tend to have lower deductibles. They do not have a lifetime limit. That's because of the Affordable Care Act. They require a number of essential benefits, including hospital stays and long-term rehabilitative care, which might be something that he might need after this injury. So he is someone who probably has quite robust health insurance.
So if somebody were to ask colleagues of Congressman Scalise, we'll let him just sit in his hospital and recover, or, you know, whatever it takes right now. But let's say his colleagues who agree with him on these issues were to be asked today, why doesn't every American have a right to the same kind of coverage that he would have if they have something that's going to be serious and long-term and expensive? What would the House Republicans' answer be?
You know, I think they would argue we are happy to set up a market where people have the option to buy health insurance, but we do not. Some of them would argue that we don't think it's the government's role to provide that health insurance. That we, and I think one of the real big philosophical differences between Democrats and Republicans here that I've kind of seen over the past, you know, 7 or 8 years covering this, is that Republicans, actually I'll start with Democrats, often think of health insurance as, you know, the thing that pays for when you go to the doctor, that it's got to be robust, it's got to cover your medical bills, it's got to be really comprehensive, whereas Republicans see it more as financial insurance, that insurance should cover, you know, prevent you from going into bankruptcy if you have an incident, a large medical incident, for example, like what Representative Scalise is going through. But it's not necessarily the case that every health insurance company should come with this like really robust, low deductible policy. And I think that's a really key policy divide that drives why you see different approaches from the two different parties.
Kathy in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm calling because I've been really a little bit shocked about the lack of outrage. I know David Leonhardt has been writing about it in opinion pages in New York Times. And why...
About the closed-door nature of these Senate deliberations on the bill, right?
Yes, I'm talking about the fact that this is going on behind closed doors and the media is not really talking about it, and that the people with the power and the money, the lobbyists, the groups from AARP, AMA, are not really, you're not hearing anything about it. And it's kind of the way it was done the second round when the bill did go through the House, where at first people were outcrying, and then they took it in the back doors and came out real quick so people couldn't speak up. So I guess my point is, my question is, where are the leaders, the powerful people, the people with the money, the organizations? Why aren't they speaking out more? And why isn't the media covering this more?
Sarah, what about the organizations, first of all? Are the ones Kathy mentioned, AMA, AARP, there would be others being quieter right now than they were at the height of the House health debate?
So I think it's actually a little bit bigger than that, even, that I think health interest groups have been really quieter than I expected throughout, you know, both the House and Senate debate, where you've seen groups like the American Medical Association, for example, which represents doctors, they've put out statements saying they oppose the Republican plan, but you know, there's a big difference between putting out a statement and kind of, you know, running a like scorched earth advertising lobbying campaign. And they haven't gone up to that level. It has felt, and I think, you know, the David Leonhardt column, you know, that the listener just referenced was really about this, that it has felt like a very muted response from the healthcare industry. And I don't, you know, I haven't reported out what exactly is driving that. I think there are a few things that come to mind that, you know, these groups want to be able to work with the Republican Congress for better or worse. That means that they are not getting super aggressive in this fight. You know, some of these groups also have members who would benefit from some of the tax cuts that are in the repeal bill. So that might be a bit of a factor. But I definitely think it is true that you've seen a muted response from industry. And again, I think part of that, like, that is a outcome of the strategy of secrecy, where it is, you know, like our listener was mentioning, it is very hard to rally people around, to like get them to make phone calls and get them to, you know, go to events when there actually isn't much of the appearance of forward motion in Washington. And I think that's what Senate Republicans are betting on, that they can mute the public response by simply not giving any events to respond to.
And if the media, or much of the media, is kind of a slave to things that are known, then I guess by keeping it secret, and you were indicating this before, a lot of the media has nothing to chew on and maybe can't figure out how to talk about it. Well, I think we could talk about it by starting with the fact that we know that it's going on and it's secret. And even if we don't know the precise provisions and the precise tweaks to the House version of health reform, we've got to talk about the fact that it's going on, and there's plenty to talk about it if people in the media just use their imagination a little bit, you know. And even the very fact that it's secret is such a story, and really pretty outrageous with respect to something so significant. If they're going to pass this in, you know, the dead of the media blackout anyway, not intentional blackout, but just when people aren't paying attention in the days leading up to the 4th of July, which seems to be the intention. And then it can quickly go back to the House and quickly get signed by the president. Well, that's really quite an elaborate attempt to go under the cover of darkness.
It is. And I think, you know, I would say the cover. One other thing I think has been happening in this space is, along with this more secretive healthcare process, you've also had a lot of other big news happening. So in the past week alone, for example, we've had former FBI Director James Comey testifying before the Senate. We've had Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So it's not just the fact that this process has been secretive. It's also the fact that reporters have other stories to cover, that this is a very news heavy environment where in our newsroom, no day feels like a slow day at this point. So you have, you know, different stories competing for time. And I think that's been affecting the coverage of the Republican efforts as well, that reporters on Capitol Hill, they're really being pulled in a lot of directions, and it makes it hard to cover everything. It makes it especially hard to cover the things that are not, you know, not made super clear to reporters.
Claudia in Pleasantville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Claudia.
Hi, Brian.
Oh,
thanks
by the way, I just want to throw in one thing that relates to the last answer. Claudia, hang on one second, which is that in terms of listening, at least on this show, to people who are speaking out about this, Senator Elizabeth Warren will be among our guests tomorrow, and that will be in the same 10:30 slot. So 10:30 tomorrow for Senator Elizabeth Warren. Please make a note of it. Claudia, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. And avid listener, thank you so much for keeping us informed, Brian.
Thank you.
Just a background, I'm an adjunct professor, and there are many of us, and that means that I'm earning, if I were to work quote-unquote full-time as an adjunct, we'd be earning maybe around $30,000. We get absolutely no benefits, and there are some in better unions that might get some benefits, but basically I qualify for the tax credit in the Affordable Care Act, and it's been a lifesaver. And I also qualify for the deductible gets lowered by a certain percentage for those who are in my income bracket.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying to figure out why the heck the Republicans hate Affordable Care Act so much. And what I never hear talked about, even on your show, which is so thorough, is this 3.8% tax on net investment income. in addition to, of course, many of the other taxes, like I have it in front of me. I just Googled medical device manufacturers, health insurers, pharmaceutical manufacturers, 0.9% Medicare surtax for high earners. I have to believe, and I'd love to hear what your guest has to say about this, that the real reason that's never talked about of the hatred of the Affordable Care Act by Republicans is because the wealthy had a 3.8% is pretty high to pay for some of the benefits that people like in my position are getting with the tax credit. How come that's never discussed? That's a high tax, 3.8%.
Yes, and we certainly have talked about that here, and that is a core reason. It's not the only reason, Sarah, but I think you'd agree that it is one of the reasons that Republicans hate the bill because it's, or hate Obamacare because it's a redistribution of wealth in a way that they don't like.
Yeah, I think actually, you know, this is one place where I feel like Republicans have been a little bit transparent, is that they don't like those taxes. They want to wipe those taxes off the books. And when you get rid of those taxes, you just have a lot less money to finance a healthcare expansion. But I think, you know, I spend a lot of time listening to folks like Paul Ryan talk about why they needed to pass the American Healthcare Act. And he will talk a lot about the idea that these taxes are hurting the American economy, that they are, you know, bad for business. And at least in that front, they do seem like they have been somewhat transparent in saying, like, this is a part of Obamacare that we are devoted to getting rid of, and we are okay with the consequences of having less money to cover people.
And to take it even further, what is the redistribution of wealth and redistribution of burden under the House health care bill, which is the one we know about? Premiums would presumably go down compared to Obamacare for younger, healthier people and others who are willing to risk having less robust coverage. But premiums would go up for people middle-aged to 65 or anyone who's sick or people like the caller who would be entitled to less in the way of subsidies. That's such a core feature of Obamacare. Why do the Republicans want to unbalance premium costs as a matter of a central principle, especially by age and health status?
Yeah, so I think you're completely right about the effects, that if you were to see, let's say, just the House-passed bill, the American Healthcare Act, come into law, the individual market would look a lot more like what it looked like before the Affordable Care Act, where if you're someone who's young and healthy, you could probably get an affordable policy. If you are someone who is older and sicker, you might struggle to get coverage. And, you know, in terms of why they prefer that approach, I know there's generally a preference for, you know, having less regulation in health insurance, less mandated benefits, having a market where people who want a skimpy health insurance plan can get a skimpy health insurance plan. I think the challenge there, the thing that, you know, when I interview Republican legislators about, they have a difficult time answering questions on is, you know, how do you take care of the people who need more health care, for example? A good example is maternity benefits. That is something that 75% of health insurance plans in the individual market did not cover until Obamacare required them to cover it. And, you know, I think I hear an argument a lot from Republicans that, well, why should men have to cover this? You know, why should everyone have to pay in? And the answer is that's kind of how health insurance works, right? Like, we pay for so many things that we don't use, and we're pooling our money together. The people who need more help end up spending more, and, you know, a young, healthy person like me ends up putting in more than I take out. And, you know, it is the vision that Republicans have. It works well if you're healthy, but, you know, it does not work well if you're someone who needs a lot of health care. Those mandates actually turn out to matter a lot and to make the health insurance market work for someone who is sicker.
Carol in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Good afternoon. Good morning, really. I'm just here to say that the three men of the apocalypse, the three musketeers here, Gorka, Trump, and Bannon, have diversified the conversation. This is not a battle for health care. This is D-Day. This is Normandy. They are dismantling the EPA. They are taking away Dodd-Frank, or at least watering it down so that it's ineffectual. Every person who sits around that table paying homage to the dictator that is Trump and his family is just completely dismantling the institutions.
You're talking about that bizarre cabinet meeting yesterday where it really looked like something out of an authoritarian regime, not like any cabinet meeting from what's supposed to be the robust democracy of the United States, where one by one they went around the room and thanked President Trump for the opportunity to serve and praised him and said they were blessed by his having them there. That was some scene. For people who haven't seen it, that's what Carol is referring to on that. And regarding watering down Dodd-Frank, that, of course, is another thing we'll talk with Senator Warren about tomorrow, because her brainchild, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is one of the main things they're trying to water down. Carol, forgive me for interrupting. Yes. I was just trying to clarify some of those references.
Thank you. This is not Camelot. These are not the Knights of the Round Table. This is not a monarchy where he brings his whole family in and everybody has to pay homage to them. This is a ridiculous scene that is going on. He lost by 3 million popular votes. He goes home, the representatives go home, and they are heckled. They are practically stoned verbally to death. People are angry. People are suffering. People are waiting for them to cut taxes on billionaires. This is what we have to look forward to. When are the Democrats going to get muscular? When is Bernie Sanders going to come out of his little Vermont hobbit house and act? When is Elizabeth Warren going to fight for her bill, her life's work is that Dodd-Frank bill.
Carol, what do you think they can be doing, given that they're in the minority in the Senate and some of the versions of the health bill, for example, can't even be filibustered? What is it that you want them to be doing that they're not doing?
I want them to do what Bernie did. They have to do what Naomi Klein used to talk about. They have to get out in the streets, and they have to do what they did with the Women's March. We women over 50 we remember Vietnam. We remember everything. We study history, and we're ready to march. These people, we need leaders. We need younger or middle-aged or it's somebody who's incited to save this democracy. We are fiddling while Rome is burning. This ridiculous. You take one topic, not you, Brian, but the news picks on one topic and they saturate the air with it, just like it's an accident and we're looking at it on the road as we drive by. It's 40 miles instead of 60, and this is what's happening. One little piece of information comes out each day. Meanwhile, the Tammany Hall bosses in the back room are putting forth a health care bill that's going to disembowel 25 million people.
Carol, I'm going to leave it there because we're out of time.
We have to go into the streets. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, Sarah Cliff, health reporter for Vox, a last word on what comes next. Is this going to emerge before July 4th, as I guess the Senate Republicans' goal is, or is it just too stalled? Because even among the Republicans, they don't even have enough agreement to put this to a vote.
That is really hard to project right now, in part because we're not actually seeing where the negotiations are. You know, my sense right now is that it's going to be really hard to get a bill, you know, out and voted on within the next 2 weeks. But, you know, then again, I remember when the House ultimately passed its healthcare bill, 3 days before, they didn't have the votes, and then the votes came together and everything moved very, very quickly. And it's possible that you could have a similar scenario unfold. The healthcare debate around the American Healthcare Act, just like around Obamacare, is very unpredictable.
Are your editorial meetings at Fox, you all sit around a room and tell your editor-in-chief how blessed you are to have been given the... I'm kidding. Sarah Cliff.
I have never told Ezra Klein, our editor, that.
Sarah Cliff, health reporter for Vox. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.